Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Peter Diamandis to the broadcast. Peter is a serial entrepreneur and an international pioneer in the fields of innovation, incentive competitions, and commercial space. Some of the companies that Peter's founded or co-founded include XPRIZE, Singularity University, Human Longevity Incorporated, and Planetary Resources. He's also a prolific speaker, author of two New York Times bestselling books, an investor, and an advisor to business leaders and startups. Peter's been a lifelong entrepreneur, founding his first organization while he was still an undergraduate. He's founded well over a dozen companies, with many of his earlier ones focused on opening the space frontier for humanity. Peter sits on the boards of several companies, including Hyperloop One, and is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Economist Innovator of the Year, the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Innovation, the Lindbergh Award, as well as a variety of others. Peter holds an undergraduate degree in molecular genetics, as well as a graduate degree in aerospace engineering, both from MIT. He received an MD from Harvard Medical School. I recently caught up with Peter over the phone, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed how he chooses his business partners and the roles they play in the organization, and Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as we discussed the importance of diversified product portfolios and the need to disrupt one's own offering. We also covered Peter's interest in space and technology innovation, how these common themes run through his various companies and initiatives, how Peter divides his time and delegates responsibilities across his organizations, the accelerating pace of technological change, as well as best practices for corporate innovation, including scaling all the edges, experimentation, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Peter, your personal motto is the best way to predict the future is to create it yourself. And not so surprisingly, you're a serial entrepreneur. You founded several companies, including International Space University, XPRIZE, Singularity University, Human Longevity Incorporated, Planetary Resources, just to name a few. I'm wondering, what are the ties that bind your areas of interest that have translated into the companies that you founded? And also, I was curious how you divide your time among the various companies that you're involved with.
I think what binds them together, what is a common theme, is my passion. And they've evolved over time. My passion, as Julian so well described in the book early on, was space. And space has always been one of my core underlying passions. And I think it was during medical school, a decade or two later, that I became really enamored with the idea of extending human life, of longevity as a theme in terms of how do we extend the human lifespan. I was in medical school and at the time had been reading about species of life on Earth in the oceans, whales, turtles, certain species of shark that had lifespans measured in hundreds of years. And my feeling is, if they can, why can't we? And so that also tied to my interest in space, meaning, you know, there's a lot to explore. And if we're able to live longer, we'll get to see more of it. And then space led to the XPRIZE, and the XPRIZE led to this real empowerment of the notion that we can do extraordinary things, that technology in the hands of individuals today is growing at such an extraordinary rate that we don't need to depend upon a few wealthy robber barons or government officials to solve problems, that we're empowered more than ever before to solve our own problems. And as a result, the XPRIZE grew from a focus on space to a focus on solving solving grand challenges. That also tied into Singularity University. I had created ISU as my first university, again, driven by that space passion. But as I became more enamored with the ability that individuals had to problem solve and became enamored with the implications of exponential technologies, got to know Ray Kurzweil, the idea of creating a Singularity University that was focused on these technologies and focused on their ability to be leveraged to solve big problems. So they all weave together and they're all passion driven and they all tie back to even that theme of the best way to predict the future is create it yourself. And it's creating a future of abundance and a future of an exploring species and a future of healthy longevity. And there are areas that I'm excited about.
I do want to understand, like, how do you divide your time, but also how do you find your partners? Obviously, in each case, it requires you only have so many hours in the day, and you've chosen your partners wisely, needless to say. I'm curious how often, like, the idea comes up and you seek a partner, or if it's in the partnership that the idea itself arises, perhaps it's a bit different.
That's a great question. So a couple of points to make there. One is I've learned over the years to know what I love doing and what I'm reasonably good at and what I don't love doing and what I'm not good at. So I love the early creative phase, coming up with the idea, brainstorming the idea, laying out the vision, finding the formative team, raising the capital, and then stepping back and hiring a CEO to run it. Or if I take the CEO position myself, as I have a few times, replacing myself. It didn't matter. And the hiring, the firing, the detailed minutiae is not my forte. And so in the case with almost everything, I am very proud to have a great CEO as a partner there. I typically will take the role as executive chairman because I still am involved in some elements of the day-to-day, but it's more the strategic partnerships, it's the capital, it's the long-term big picture and not the day-to-day operation of the company. And so in the case of Planetary Resources, there's Chris Lewicki in the place in Human Longevity. It's Craig Venter and SU. It's Rob Now. It's Marcus Shingles. You know, in my venture fund, Bold Capital Partners. The only place I sort of keep a CEO role is in, I have a group called PhD Ventures, which is sort of the company that I do my speaking, my book writing, and my Abundance 360 conference. And it's sort of my little think tank. I have a group of 9 millennials that work with me, age 21 to 30, that support me across everything I do. And it's sort of my deployable team to support me in each of these companies. And I'll pretty much split my time equally in supporting them. If I had had a large exit 20 years ago, I might have built all of these things within a single company, like Branson's done in the Virgin Group or Larry Page has done inside of Google or Alphabet. But they've all been built independently in order to have them properly capitalized. And for me, it's a joy. I love the constant freshness and the constant new challenges. And I'll either go from huge opportunity to opportunity or from challenge to challenge, depending on what phase each company is in.
One of the central themes in your work is that the pace of technology change is accelerating, and it's very difficult to argue with that, certainly. And you note that companies have to disrupt themselves or risk being disrupted, also very difficult to argue with that. I'm curious, obviously, we've just been talking about the companies that you have founded. In each case, these were startups. But as you take the lessons that you've learned and you apply them and work with more traditional, say, Fortune 500 organizations that are many decades old and have legacy technologies, to say nothing of legacy culture, and mentalities. I'm curious, do you have any sort of lessons that separate those organizations that can adjust, can disrupt themselves versus those that are at risk of not doing so?
There are a few important cases. A lot of it goes into the ability of a company to rapidly experiment and iterate. And the companies that are really the most successful, the ones that are crushing it, like Uber and Google, even SpaceX and whoever you want to put in that list, it's these companies are constantly experimenting. I know inside of Uber and Google X, they're running literally 1,000+ experiments per year. And creating a culture that allows for rapid experimentation and constant failure and iteration is really critically important. And it's very tough for other companies to do that because the only constant is change, and everybody's core business goes to zero eventually. There are very few 100-year-old companies. And so if your core business is eventually going to be disrupted, are you experimenting and creating new businesses on the edge in adjacencies that as they rise, you can jump onto them? You know, I like to say that the day before something is truly a breakthrough, it's a crazy idea. And so where in your company are you trying breakthroughs? Where are you trying crazy ideas? Because if you're not, you're stuck in a period of incrementalism.
I spoke with Rob Nail actually earlier this week, in fact, and he also talked about this concept of innovating at the edge. You don't necessarily disrupt immediately your core business, but find ways, even if it is eventually heading down a path towards cannibalization, be bold and do so at the edge, and eventually maybe the edges become the core.
Yeah, exactly. And what you see is very few companies have ever disrupted themselves. Honestly, it's a handful. But what you've seen companies do is disrupt their adjacencies. You've seen companies disrupt upstream and downstream, their suppliers and their customers. So you see Apple, for example, not really disrupting or modifying their core computer business, but they've gone into the phone business and then into the music business and then into the app business. And then you've seen Amazon go from selling books to publishing books and creating content and creating their own brands of diapers, whatever the case might be. It's crazy.
In your book, Bold, you and your co-author, Stephen Kotler, describe 6 Ds of exponential disruption: digitized, deceptive, disruptive, demonetized, dematerialized, democratized. And I'm curious, you know, in a thumbnail sketch level, I wonder if you can describe how organizations should be thinking about these, whether startups or existing businesses. How do you see these applying?
When I talk to Fortune 500 CEOs or boards, my conversation with them is along the lines of, which of your core products or services are you actively working on dematerializing and demonetizing right now? Because I guarantee you someone else is. And if you're not trying to dematerialize and demonetize your products and services, and someone does it to you, you're out of business. And the benefit of dematerializing and demonetizing your core products and services is that you get to democratize them and get to provide them around the world. And then I remind people also that over the next 6 to 8 years, we're going to see a world that will have likely 8 billion people connected digitally. In 2010, we were at 1.8 billion people online. Today, it's close to about 3 billion people. But you've got amazing projects by Facebook and by Google and by SpaceX and by Qualcomm and Branson at OneWeb. And you've got all these efforts that are looking to connect 8 billion people with a megabit per second connection. And so all of a sudden, we're going to see this huge explosion in the number of new clients coming on, new customers coming on, a huge, very long tail. And that long tail isn't going to be served with bricks and mortars of people. It's going to be digital, dematerialized, demonetized products and services. And so that's a lot of the conversation I'll have.
Singularity University has a track dedicated to foresight and futures studies. What methods do you recommend as you advise business leaders on how best to predict or dream up future scenarios?
The conversation is a lot around having them understand what's going on in each of the exponential technology areas: computation, sensors and networks, AI, robotics, digital manufacturing, AR and VR, synthetic genomics, sort of the way I think about the categories of technologies. And then understanding what's in the lab today and what's coming to market in a 2 to 5 year horizon is really important. And then what I ask executives to do is to say, okay, what are your 3 biggest problems that, if were solved, would transform your business? I also ask them to think about, what are your 3 biggest strengths that really uniquely is why you are doing well? You know, what are the strengths that give you your value? And then I'll say, okay, as we talk about each of these technology areas, how might AI solve your challenges or disrupt your strengths? Because that's the way you need to be thinking about it. And we'll go through each of these technology areas and people will sort of gain insights. The other thing that I focused on with them is trying to help them see convergence coming, help them understand and see what's coming down the pike as these different exponential technologies are creating new business models. And it's the business model creation that's the most interesting. It's not really one technology. It's the sharing economy that becomes enabled and then the various business models within that versus just wireless connectivity and GPS.
You've mentioned, understandably, AI a couple of times, and you are very much an optimist in terms of what AI will do for the world, what it will do for us as individuals in ways of augmenting our own mental capacity. There are, of course, as you know, many people who are quite pessimistic. Even people who are deeply involved in AI are worried about some of the safety implications, for lack of better terminology. And I'm curious, why do you believe they're wrong, in your opinion?
I believe that increased intelligence brings a increased understanding, appreciation, empathy than not. I think the danger of AI is, as a tool, there are still going to be evil actors in society, and it's their use of the tool that has a potential for doing harm. It's not necessarily the tool itself that is going to do harm. What I've seen over and over again is, as humans, we tend to see the negative much further ahead than the positive. Meaning, if we see a fire in the distance or a potential disruption in the distance, our brains tend to focus on the negative 10 times better than the positive. And we see the problem in the future and we accelerate it to today and we make it a problem that we are facing today. And then it's, oh my God, this is happening. But what we forget is that we're going to actually encounter that problem some years from now. And the progress we make between today and that future point typically gives us a new set of tools to solve that problem. So, for example, the big environmental problem of the late 1800s was horse manure. As people moved out of the rural areas into the urban areas and brought their motive force, the horse, with them, the amount of horse literally piled up was causing disease. And the prediction of what would happen in cities as the population continued to grow and the number of horses continued to increase was devastating. And of course, the solution to that problem was the invention of the automobile. And it became the new motive force, and the horse population dropped precipitously. And so I think that we tend to go dystopian easily and quickly. I also see AI as a tool that's giving us a meta tool to solve problems at a faster and faster rate. And so at the XPRIZE Foundation, we launched this partnership with IBM Watson called the IBM Watson AI XPRIZE. And it's really a prize focused on having teams around the world demonstrate the grand challenge they can solve in collaboration with AIs.
You're involved with many projects that will play out over several decades, asteroid mining and longevities, to name a couple. I'm curious, though, what are some of the more immediate innovations that you're excited about in, say, the 1 to 3 year time horizon?
I have this conversation going on, Abundance 360. I think autonomous cars are going to have a huge impact over the next 2 to 5 years. They're going to fundamentally change how we're living our lives in a substantial fashion. I think we're going to see augmented and VR having a huge impact. And of course, AI is as well, changing the game a multitude of different ways. So it's kind of hard to find a tech that's not going to be interesting for us.
I'm wondering, how long do you plan to live? And do you have a perspective on the quality of your life, physically and mentally, in your later years?
You know, when I was in medical school years ago, I remember seeing a program on long-lived sea animals. And the theoretically longest lived animal was, you know, sea turtles at 700 years. And I remember saying, if they can live that long, why can't we? And so I set sort of a dated crazy goal, and I admit it's a crazy goal of 700 years because, frankly, if you can live a couple hundred years, you can live forever, right? In other words, the concept of an indefinite lifespan happens sometime in the not-too-distant future. I'm 55 now. Do I think that I can get to over 100? Absolutely. And do I believe that in the next 45 years, we're going to crack the code on extreme human longevity, indefinite lifespan? Absolutely. So now, of course, the question of quality of life comes in.
Indeed.
And my dad just recently died at 87 with a very rapid decline in the last 4 or 5 years with dementia. And that's no way to live. And so my mantra, I have two companies involved in the longevity space. One is Human Longevity, Inc., HLI, which is a genomics and data science company. The other company is a company that's just getting a start now called Cellularity. And Cellularity is a stem cell company. They're sister companies. The mantra there is, how can you have the aesthetics, the mobility, and the cognition at 100 that you had at 60, right? How do you maintain that over time? And I think that's really at least the goal.
Well, Peter Diamandis, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking time with me. It's been a great conversation. So thank you.
My pleasure, Peter.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World-Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World-Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World-Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.